You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. We're recording this section of the Book Riot Podcast on Monday, February 21st. I'm going to cry. 2022. We recorded the back half last week. Rebecca, we had a little tech glitch. We lost the first 15 minutes or so of the show. We'll talk about it here in a minute. So it's a little bit of a chimera, a griffin, a centaur. You know what they like to do in the olden times is mix their animals up in mythology.
They sure did.
Yeah.
I was thinking it's more like a jump in the Wayne's World Wayback Machine. Like, we'll talk here for 15 minutes, and then we can go like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah, that's
and
right. We should probably get that.
Yeah, you can hear us last Thursday when you asked me how I was doing, and I couldn't answer.
you just came up, return null. Just, yes,
yeah,
existing.
Yeah, right, Right. It's Monday morning. I'm highly caffeinated. Mm. We're not in a moment of existential crisis yet. The week is too new.
That's right.
It's too young. So here we are.
So depending on how good of an edit point I find, you might find a weird Wayne's World edit point sound effect tournament. I'm not exactly sure how this is going to go. It's an adventure every day, Rebecca. But before we do that, we're going to take it for a sponsor and try to somewhat recreate what we talked about before, because it's worth talking about a little bit more.
Yeah, I think so.
Today's episode is brought to you by Scribner. Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman is a collection of seven stories in which characters pursue their obsessions on paths to glory and destruction, while all around them their worlds twist and warp, oscillating between reality and impossibility. On display throughout is Cotman's ability to reveal truths about the human experience, about things like friendship, love, betrayal, bitterness, all through whimsy, horror, and fantasy. Elegiac in tone, imaginative, and humorous in their execution, the character-driven stories in Weird Black Girls challenge, incite, and entertain. The author's last book was named one of NPR's Best Books of the Year and was a finalist for the Philip K. Dick Award, with reviews appearing in the New York Times, Wired, BuzzFeed, and Locus, among other publications. Definitely make sure to check out Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman. And thanks again to Scribner for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by National Geographic Books. So take a second, think to yourself, what is one of the like weirdest but kind of interesting, intriguing, intelligent animals that you know of? If you, like me, think of an octopus, then Secrets of the Octopus by Cy Montgomery is the book for you. It is a beautifully illustrated book that explores the underwater world of the octopus, a creature that resembles an alien life form, but whose behavior has earned it a reputation as one of the most intelligent animals on the planet. This journey into the world of the octopus reveals how large their brains are. They occupy their whole body, not just their heads. They can adjust their genetic makeup to respond to the demands of the environment. So with this book, you can see how the octopus can change shape and color to camouflage themselves more effectively than any other species. They are cool AF. So learn about all of this and more in Secrets of the Octopus. And thanks again to National Geographic Books for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, so the first things first is putting a little cap on the Gumroad experimentation we've done around bonus content. I think we've learned enough now that we're not going to do any more of those, but we're going to explore some sort of subscription membership thing where you get different, new, more content for dollars over time. We're still putting together mm-hmm. the pieces of what this might look like. And I think we're going to, I'm not going to have it up today because we didn't do it yet, but in the coming weeks, we're going to have a link to a survey in the show where you can go kind of rank the stuff you might like to have. And we're kind of going to middle that with what we actually can do, we want to do. The one thing we're cognizant of over time, having done other subscription services, Book Riot Insiders and TBR and other things, is you got to do it forever, right? It's all nice and good to say, ah, this would be fun and we could add this. And then suddenly you're doing that 6 years from now and you're like, why are we doing anything that and it's hard to roll back. But we want to figure out what might be useful there. So if you still got a few ideas from people when I asked for this last week.
Oh, nice.
Nothing we haven't seen before, but sure would like as much signal from y'all as possible. You can email us podcast@bookriot.com. Rebecca, anything else that comes to mind to get people's mental juices flowing?
Yeah, I'm just especially interested in if you've subscribed to like premium content from other podcasts that you listen to, what you really enjoy about that. And also if you've seen stuff in those experiences that you didn't super like, that would be really interesting for us to know so that we don't maybe waste our time going down those paths. We've both, are dedicated podcast listeners to many things. We've looked at a lot of options, but hearing from y'all about what would be exciting and interesting to you, what kind of extra time you want to spend with us, aside from, the Lonesome Dove read along.
Right.
Would be really
well, that's going to come right. That's going to come day one. That'll be a launch perk for the
well, obviously we're going to do that. We had talked about, or you and I have talked about, like sort of setting some benchmarks of if we get to a certain number of subscribers, introducing, different kinds of additional content. And, I have not written off the idea of Lonesome Dove, but it would take a lot of people opting in to whatever this thing is.
It would have to be
a
crowded dove, let's say, to get
enough of us to
commit to that.
And I think one thing that you mentioned the first time we recorded this segment that I want to make sure we don't forget is that we've also considered ways that we could use subscribership to the bonus content to support additional content that would happen on the regular show, so that folks who can't afford to subscribe to bonus material or who for some reason don't want to could still, if a certain number of y'all were paying in for the bonus content, we could still do additional fun things that didn't have to be ad supported in our regular feed. So there's all kinds of stuff we're trying to consider, the needs of our business, the interests of the audience, and also balancing that everybody in the audience isn't in the same position. Mm-hmm. So let us know what you'd like to do.
Yeah, I think the simplest thing, it's kind of what the Gumroot experiment was at its core doing, right or wrong, was taking a kind of content block out of the main feed that would normally go there and put it behind a paywall. I think we'd like to not do that. So if we have something that's an hour long of us talking that looks and sounds like a pod episode, it goes in the main feed just because that's what we do. We like that. We like most of the people to get that. But are there some things that don't really fit in a way that makes sense that we could do? And then could support for, direct support mean we make more of those things? Because we don't have the kinds of advertisers that if we made 9 shows a month, we could support that. We just don't have that many that could do it. We have at this level, maybe a little bit more, but people I think might want more content than advertising alone would support. I guess that's kind of the theory of all these kind of subscription models,
yes,
right? Is that there's excess desire for more content that advertising sponsorship doesn't really make possible. And we're going to try to find if there's a sweet spot. And there may not be. We'll try it over. We're going to try something. We'll see how long it lasts. But yeah, I really do like that idea of maybe the subscription doesn't even get you anything else, but it goes into the hat that then produces shows that show up in the regular feed. Because one thing, if anything we learned from Gumroad, I would say, the single biggest takeaway I would take, is redundant, but it didn't feel that way when I said it. And I'm curious if you agree with me, is that people like to listen to pods where they listen to pods, which sounds like a tautology, but it's very true. And I totally get it.
I totally get it. Yeah. I think most frequent complaint about the Gumroad thing was that it was clunky to get it into your podcatcher. Mm. It didn't play nicely with all of the podcatchers. The tech was not completely intuitive. And I share those feelings as a podcast listener. I want to listen to my podcast in the place where I listen to them. I bailed on one long time podcast app that I had used for 6 years when they did an update that made it harder to find what I was looking for. I think we all want that to be a streamlined experience. So moving to something that's not one-off experimental like Gumroad, but that is, more sustainable, that's built for delivering bonus podcast content so that folks can access it in the places that they regularly listen to their shows is something that's high priority for us. Yeah. So we want it to be a good experience. And we do appreciate that y'all went along with us on the experiment of clunkiness just to get some baseline data.
That's right. Okay, so enough of that for now. So the first thing we did last week, it was a bit of a curveball. Rebecca wasn't ready for it, and it was delightful, and we had a lot of fun. And it's really all joking aside about the editing or whatever, it's like one of the sometimes with tech glitches, we lose something and we have to go do it, and we just talk about the same story or record something else. Part of the fun of this was that Rebecca wasn't ready for it, and it's spontaneous. So the game was, and I kind of came up with it because I wanted to talk about a recent trip I had made to Pals, and I was looking at my Pals here on Hawthorne in Portland, don't be creepy, where has the wall of Pals bestsellers. And I was looking, and the top three there were interesting to me, and I wanted Rebecca to guess what it was. And so we played a game of 20 questions where she could ask yes or no questions to try to narrow down through the power of reverse compounding, really, when you think about what 20 questions is, getting there. And so we're not going to replicate it, right? But we're going to kind of walk through what happened. So one thing I did there is I paused for a minute to ask the listener, do you think that Rebecca is going to get it? So ask your listener. You're the listener, right? You right there, you. What if that's going to happen? And B, if your answer is yes, how many questions do you think it's going to take? And at the moment, we did not know what was going to happen, right, Rebecca? So just so you know, we had no idea how this was going to go.
I was still deeply in that "how are you doing" existential crisis, so it was like, who knows what's going to happen.
You know, I sensed weakness and I pounced. To be honest with you, is kind of how that worked. So
this is the price I pay for being game.
Right. Yeah, but for being honest, no good deed goes unexploited. So Rebecca, we did this, and before telling people the results, kind of how did you proceed? Do you remember how you proceeded?
Let's see. So you had just also been talking about a publisher's weekly bestsellers list that you were looking at. So I remember starting there, asking if the book that was the Powell's bestseller was on the publisher's weekly. I think it was hardcover fiction bestseller.
That's correct.
That
was your first question.
Yeah. And you said no. And I was like, okay, so it's not on hardcover fiction bestsellers. I don't remember the order that I went in, but I
don't necessarily either. Yeah.
I did. I asked if it was hardcover. I asked if it was fiction. I asked if the author was a woman.
Yep.
I asked if the author was a person of color. And
I think you also asked if it was published in 2021, meaning a relatively recent, because you figured out by asking about the hardcover,
right?
Or somehow you figured out it wasn't in hardcover. Maybe there was another question about, is it in hardcover at all? Not just on the hardcover fiction bestsellers list.
I think I did ask if it was in hardcover and you said no. And so then I asked if it was published in 2021, like, okay, it's in paperback, but how recent of a paperback was I that's where I was trying to get.
Yes.
And
somewhere in there, I started breaking in terms of giving a little more. A little more, my yeses and nos and interstitial commentary became pregnant.
You took a little mercy on me.
Yes,
and you said something that, like, I would be delighted by the answer. I think I don't remember if I had guessed any other titles, but I eventually asked, is it Taylor Jenkins Reid's debut novel, Daisy Jones and the Six?
And I laughed and said no.
You laughed and said no, and there was a little something more there to it. And so I said, oh, is it the one with the seven husbands?
That's
and
right.
In fact, it was.
In fact, it was the number one pick on the Powell's list. And so we started laughing about her debut her debut novel. Just announced a sequel to Malibu Rising. Did you see that over the weekend?
Carrie Soto was back. Yes, I did. I saw that.
Speaking of Striking While the Iron is Hot. So we got on a little bit of a conversation about that list, that book, what Powell's wall looks like, and then the publisher's weekly list, and then what people are actually buying. And those are three interestingly different things. Right now, the top three at Powell's, again, this was last week, so maybe it's changed, it was the Taylor Jenkins Reid's debut novel, Mexican Gothic by Sylvia Marina Garcia. Is that right? I haven't read the book, so I can't remember. Or did I read? Maybe it doesn't matter. And then the third book is A Court of Thorn and Roses, Roses and Thorns by Sarah J. Maas.
Thorns and Roses.
Thorns and Roses, which is the first of this giant series that's become a phenomenon in its own right. The biggest series that only book nerds know about, or only book readers. It hasn't been adapted. I haven't even heard about rumblings, weirdly, in this gold rush of adaptation. I'm sure it's been optioned, but there's not a trailer or anything else coming. And we're talking about TikTok, right? These are all kind of TikTok mm-hmm. books, I think, except for Mexican Gothic. And we spent a moment saying, I haven't seen that. I'm off TikTok, so I don't know. But those other ones I'd seen a bunch. And then how on the Publisher's Weekly list, they're really only capturing front list. And there's just this one mini box with top 10 overall. And on that, the debut novel of Taylor Jenkins Reid didn't even appear. So there's a distinction between Powell's and that list. And then on Powell's wall, there's no Colleen Hoover books. And Colleen Hoover mm-hmm. has like three spots because of TikTok. and we got into a thing about how some of Colleen Hoover's books and some of the ebooks and then some of the print books are Amazon joints. Like one of them is Montlake, one's Grand Central, which is a Hachette. So Powell's may not even be covering, carrying a bunch of these mm-hmm. Colleen Hoover books, but it wasn't on the top 30. So I didn't know what to make of that. So it was a very interesting moment to talk about where we are in book selling, what else we might find interesting, and how there's like sort of pockets developing. And then the ongoing story I do want to keep in people's minds, and I want to look at this more, is these authors that are getting a huge boost from TikTok, the Madeline Millers, the Sarah J. Masses, the Taylor Jenkins Reids, the Colleen Hoovers. You get to see a pattern here, and they're white ladies, right? Mm-hmm. And I've been looking around for, you know, what are the top 50 authors that we can attribute TikTok success to? Like, what do they look like? Because we've talked about how on the bestsellers list, as much as there's more diversity and inclusion of marginalized voices in the publishing industry, and it is true, and there's still a long way to go, but it's different than it was 10 years ago. There's just no way to say it wasn't. When you look at the best-selling books, though, there hasn't been a lot of movement there. Most of the time, mm-hmm. we talked about in the Publisher's Weekly list of the best-selling books of 2021. We look at one, just the algorithm goes crazy, and that's what TikTok is. It's just algorithm gone wild, which is, show title, which is basically reinforcing people's pre-existing tastes and biases and opinions and, you know, recency confirmation. All the Bob Thaler, Kahneman and Tversky stuff is at play in the algorithm. And so that's the other side of the coin. I think TikTok is selling more books, and it's selling books of things that maybe weren't going to sell a whole bunch by themselves, but the thing it's not doing, and you wouldn't expect it to, right? You wouldn't expect it to go against the grain of people's pre-existing biases. So there you go.
Yeah, you wouldn't. And the base rates really contribute to that. That just such a small percentage of books published in any given year, and also then a small percentage of the total books available in the world are by, or at least in, you know, Western culture, are by people of color. So the likelihood of any particular book by a person of color getting like plucked out and have a TikTok video made about it that then goes viral and makes a billion other people read it is just much, much lower than the likelihood of that happening to books by white people because of those base rates. I would love to see it happen, and I'm skeptical that it will, for all of those reasons that you were just listing, that these algorithms take, you know, they are built off of your biases. They take what you spend the most time looking at, and we're most likely to look at things that are familiar and that we're already interested in. And most of the books that make it up to popular familiarity and have big marketing pushes or that you've heard people talk about in mainstream media are still all of those places are still dominated by books by white people. Yep. So there's just a lot going against it, but I would love to see some, you know, like if you've got juice on TikTok and have a little power, think about the books that you're featuring and about the potential influence of that situation.
Or data points. Maybe Mexican Gothic has been going nuts on TikTok. And I'm like, and so there's something else happening. I'd love to have more data. I frankly love my theory here to be wrong. Frankly, that would be the best outcome.
Yes,
that
would be the best outcome. And I think we did also at some point in this discussion decide that we were going to read The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo and talk
about
it. I think
you decided that and I just kind of missed it. You know,
you just went along with it.
Strike three. It was a called strike. Looking there, I'm curious to see. I like Taylor Jenkins.
We're both gonna do it. Yeah, I like her too. She's fun.
Okay, I think right in here there'll be some sort of magical editing that I'm going to do, Rebecca. So that's the end of our re-record. We'll talk to people in like 2 seconds, but then also not until next week. Okay, that's curveball one. You ready for curveball two? It's not really, this is not, I can't think of a way. I've been trying this whole, while I was quizzing you about the other stuff, I was trying to think of another way to do it. I can't really think of it in a way that's fun. It would just be a number. But Bookshop's second anniversary was, let's see, a couple weeks ago. And they took out a giant cover ad on for those of you who don't know, Publishers Weekly basically skins the whole mag in a front and back cover with inside and outside covers ad for whoever wants to buy it. I want to know how much it is. I've never gotten up the temerity to ask, but usually I'm not super interested, but Bookshop really wants to make it clear how well things are going. And I thought, mm-hmm. we haven't talked about Bookshop in a while.
We haven't. No, it's been a while.
And I thought it was interesting to see what their numbers are. So okay. I'm just going to give them to you, and maybe we can figure out what is interesting here. So I'm going to just, here's their by the numbers box. Bookstores mm-hmm. worldwide, colon, over $21 million earned.
Okay.
U.S. bookstores, colon, $18.7 million earned.
Okay.
1,323. Wait, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Is this in sales or profit?
Distributed to? So I'm guessing. So
I
don't,
because
that's bookshop.org.
So this is like the revenue
the
share.
Yeah.
This is like the revenue share that the bookstores get.
Right. Okay. Yes, that's my understanding. Good question.
Okay.
1,323 bookstores have earned $12.7 million in bookshop.org direct commissions.
Mm-hmm.
1,391 bookstores split $6 million from our profit sharing pool.
Okay.
51,023 affiliates link to bookshop.org. 78% of bookshop.org customers use to buy their books from Amazon.
Okay.
There's just a big pie graph with no units. I'm not going to do that. I think those are all the salient numbers. Anything from that strike you?
Yeah, it's $12.7 million went to like
1,300-ish bookstores in direct commissions.
So that's like an average of $100,000 per bookstore.
Is that right?
Which
I did the math differently because I didn't get that number. 12.7 million divided by 1,323 equals, I got $10,000.
Oh, yes. Yep, that would be right.
Or 9,600. 9,600 total.
How things are going today is that I can't make the calculator work right.
So then
like
if we divide that by two, we divide that by two, so their annually, the average bookstore got $4,800
less than
from
five.
Bookshop. I'm not sure how to feel about that number. Is that good? Is that bad? Is it meaningful? Is it, what do we make of that?
I don't think that number.
$400 a month, the average participating bookstore has gotten from bookshop.org.
I don't think that number means anything by itself, but I understand why they would present it, because $12.7 million is a lot of dollars. And probably most people aren't doing the math we're doing of like $10,000 per bookstore over 2 years divided by 12 months. Like, it's only meaningful really if it's additive business at all to the bookstores.
Right.
So like, are these customers that they weren't getting otherwise because they didn't have some sort of, you know, online retail, and so they used Bookshop.
Mm.
The stores, my understanding is that indie stores that had really robust online retail are not using Bookshop links because they already had robust online retail, and the ones that work with the ABA have like a full setup from that back end. So we can't separate the fact that COVID has happened during basically like the entire existence of Bookshop, and some of those stores did not have online retail, and probably the Bookshop numbers bolstered them when they had to close in early COVID, especially if they didn't have online sales. So it was like, if you were going to make $0 or you were going to make $500 because you could sell things through Bookshop, that's better than nothing. So that might have been a bolstering effect, but I'm skeptical that it was additive for many bookstores, and for the ones it was additive for, I guess skeptical that it was additive enough to matter in any ongoing health of the business way.
It's hard to say, because two caveats. So what I just did is a straight line average, right? So the number of bookstores they sold
right
as a function, or the number of dollars, and then the number of bookstores over time. you know, the first 6 months of Bookshop, it was probably very small. So what is the rolling 12-month average right now? What's going on with that number? I could believe it's a lot higher.
Sure.
And then what is the standard deviation? Because I just did average, and right. of late I've been interested in right. medians. Like, so I don't know how to make sense of that number with some sense of distribution.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And if that average is pulled up by a couple stores that did like gangbusters with Bookshop, then it's like good for those couple stores that did tons and tons of revenue. And then we would assume that a lot of stores did a lot less than the 10,000 over 10 years if things were pulled up by those outliers. So actually, I think that's where I would land. I would guess that a couple stores really benefited
yeah.
from having Bookshop, and that the rest of the stores who have it, it's better than losing a sale. Because you're not, because your store's not open, or because you didn't have online retail and a customer didn't want to come to the store. But I remain, I think, skeptical that it, let me rephrase it this way. I don't think Bookshop is saving any independent bookstores in the long term, like, or keeping them open when otherwise they would be closing. Not that that's the only function of Bookshop, right. but like an ongoing contribution that just sort of bolsters independent bookstores is great. That's fine. It's nice. You know, $5,000 a year is not nothing when you're running a business that has like a 2% profit margin.
I think if I summarize what you're just saying a little bit, I'm going to submit a ticket to the Court of Truth real quick. And the Court of Truth stat is how many bookstores are open today that wouldn't be open without Bookshop?
Right. Yeah.
That would be the number I like to hear. They picked a testimonial. Would you like to hear this testimonial? Because it's both persuasive and misleading. At this. No, here we go. This is from Daniel Mullen. This is a big ad for, this is non-sponcon, bookshop.org hasn't paid for this spot. Bookseller okay. Spotlight on the back. This is who they chose to put on here, right? This is, so take that for what it's will. Daniel Mullen of Semicolon Bookstore and Gallery in Chicago, Illinois. Black woman-owned business merging a love for art and literature in a unique gallery space. Here's her quote. We're booksellers. What we want to do is talk to people in our store and sell and talk about books. We can't talk to you if we're packing up 1,000 boxes. Okay. Then here's their blurb in prose. Semicolon Bookstore and Gallery has earned over $1.5 million in revenue from sales on bookshop.org, all without packing a single order. $1.5 million? So that shop alone has gotten 10%. It's
like, yes, right.
So is that, does that make us feel, what do you do with that? I mean, great for Danielle. Shouts to Semicolon Bookstore and Gallery in Chicago, Illinois.
Yeah,
that sounds
good
great.
Job to them. Whatever they did to advertise their Bookshop stuff, A+. And I guess, like, for our listeners who don't know, the way that this works is if you order a book
right.
through Bookshop that is connected to a particular independent bookstore, the store gets a kickback of revenue share, but the book is fulfilled, I believe, by Ingram. The booksellers don't have to spend their time processing that order, which is one of the other appealing things, as that bookseller is saying, about using Bookshop rather than having your own online ordering system. Because as we also saw in early COVID, a lot of independent bookstores just became online fulfillment
yes.
centers. Like yes. that was a good situation. It was a good problem for them to have, that their communities were showing up and buying books at such a volume that they were, you know, just spending 8 hours a day packing things up and shipping them out.
Right.
But that's not what you get into the book business to do.
No.
I think if you have to break down the overall Bookshop numbers and decrease that 1.5 million, take away the 1.5 million from the 12.7. So it's what, 11.2 yeah. million across 1200 and whatever. Like,
well, I'm guessing they picked the outlier, right? They picked what's the
yes.
best one to pick.
Right. What's
right?
the best story? Right. I mean, this is what you do when you're touting.
Yeah,
how well
no, that's fine.
Have
that's fine. And we put that
fine.
Into the pot of evaluation to figure it out. I guess another
yeah,
question we want is this a bell curve distribution, right? Like, how is this yeah. distributed? Because I'm guessing Daniel Mullen is an outlier on the right hand
yes.
side of a bell curve distribution.
One would
but
assume.
But how much of an outlier, right? What's the
what actually
median
is the average?
25 to 75th deciles or percentiles of people getting? Because the other quote on the front is from Noel Santos, who we know a little bit and liked and followed over the years. Because
the
of bookshop.org, I'm not concerned about our viability. I can thrive rather than just survive. So my working hypothesis right now, Rebecca, is that there is a meaningful number of bookstores at that right end of the distribution curve that are getting meaningful, substantial, business-altering business from bookshop.org. How many?
What is your meaningful number of bookstores?
More than three.
More than three is meaningful. Okay. Out of 1,270 that got revenue from Bookshop?
Or there are, well, I don't know about meaningful. Let me take that modifier off the board. There are bookstores for whom Bookshop.org has made a meaningful impact, either staying in business or really doing awesome. Because this is 1.5 million from this is a that's doing awesome for an individual
bookstore.
Yeah,
and I guess the thing we can't know about this is for Semicolon in Chicago and for Noel's store in the Bronx, if they had tossed up, I don't know when their bookshop stuff launched, but if they had tossed up
or their own website
or their own like really robust online retail, which I'm not Googling while we're talking on the show, so I don't know if you can just order directly from them, but if they're following that typical model in indie bookstores where you're either using Bookshop or you have your own ordering system, I'm going to assume for the purposes of this conversation, knowing that I might be wrong, that they're just using Bookshop. We can't know how much higher this is because of it or lower.
Nope.
Like there might have been people who there's just a bunch of unknowns. People might have bounced out because they didn't recognize what Bookshop was, or they might have bounced out if they had to create an account at an independent bookstore's website, or nothing. There might be no difference, but we can't know those things. So I feel like it has an asterisk next to it. Like these stores have really benefited from the existence of Bookshop. Yes. If you made $1.5 million in revenue from it, Undeniably, you benefited.
Yeah.
Could you have made that in some other way if Bookshop didn't exist is the big open question that brings my asterisk.
Yeah, and then how are all these, how are you getting all of these sales through Bookshop? Like, I don't understand. My guess is some sort of online campaign. That's the only thing I can figure out. Like, why is this the outlier, I guess? What happened to make this an outlier?
Yeah, I would guess it was some support independent bookstores, Save Our Neighborhood bookstore. Here's where you can buy books.
Yeah.
Yada, yada. Because the average revenue at like a mid-size, like not Powell's, not the Strand. 1.5 million is on the very high end.
Very high side. Shop Around a Corner did $250,000 of business, according to You've Got Mail in 1998. So I'm kidding. That's not anything. But
and they were paying Manhattan rent.
It was different. It was the 90s, Rebecca. It was different
that's
back
true.
Then. Yeah, I guess I find myself with more questions than answers. The deeper we go into the bookshop. I mean, they're around. People like them. Every now and again, see a bookshop.org is not as great for us as people think, but I think in any group where you have 1,300 participants, there's going to be a few percentage of people that don't have a great experience. I think that's acceptable and nothing to be concerned about. I'm just having a hard time wrapping my mind around how to think about $12 million-ish. Well, and then there's this profit-sharing pool. If we really look at that, that one is... You're just on the store, but it's not directly through your store. That's another $6 million. So $18.7 million earned over 2 years during a pandemic when bookstores were closed and looking for a lifeline. Is that great performance? And I guess I still don't know. And how it affects the larger firmament, does it buttress independent bookstores from Amazon, which is the thing? They said we don't, that's not what we're trying to do is convert people to Amazon, but then that's all they talk about. So I don't know how to do that either. At the same time, I find it super fascinating. So
I think it's really
18 minutes of talking with no resolution. Welcome to the Book Riot podcast.
I think it's really interesting. I think where I'm landing on Bookshop is they're around. And I think that's good and fine. We like diversity of options in the marketplace. Whether it ultimately contributes to propping up independent bookstores or extending the lifeline of them against Amazon or consolidation from publishers or anything is a different question. But I don't think that Bookshop is a failure. If it doesn't do that. I don't think you're saying that either. But we might we slash people who were super excited about the launch of Bookshop might have been like asking too much of it from the jump. And I think Bookshop contributes to this narrative that like we are going to save independent bookstores. That's a really high ask. I would be surprised if many of the independent bookstores participating think that it's likely or think that that's the reason that they're participating with Bookshop. But they're around. It's a resource. Making an extra on average $5,000 a year is better than not making it, if it is in fact extra that you wouldn't have gotten before. It's good for consumers to have options. And it does further some kind of conversation about why would you leave Amazon and what are the options? It's nice to have multiple answers to the where can I buy my books that's not Amazon question for people. And I think interesting to see someone try this model and try to find a way to do business, support a bunch of independent bookstores, which all run their businesses very differently.
Yeah.
And do their own PR for like why it's good to be around. But I guess I kind of am talking myself into like, I kind of don't care if we never get Bookshop numbers again. I think that's where I'm at. Like, unless someone from Bookshop is going to roll out and be like, here is what all of this actually means and here's how we take it. And then somebody from the ABA is going to talk about the actual impact on most stores of it. Like, okay, you're here. Like, you're just here and that's fine. And I think it's good for the market that there are options. I'm over the PR press for
it. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing to say is like, if you're just going to trot these numbers out every year, I don't know what kind of context to put that in. You know what I think bookshop.org is good for is bookshop.org.
Scribd. Yeah.
Because if you think about, I'm not sure, I'm not going to do the live on air breaking down their profit and revenue sharing, but let's say that they're paying out 10% of sales in commissions. It's probably something like that, right? So that means the $21 million distributed to all bookstores internationally means that Bookshop itself has taken in $210 million in gross sales over 2 years. That's a lot of books.
Yeah, that is a lot of books. To move through.
Now, does it offer a service that if there was a good sort of bog standard white labelable front end that the ABA had, we used to call this IndieBound. Wasn't that what it was? What was that thing called?
Yeah.
It was Does Bookshop actually it add anything other than a being a feature that bookstores can use? Does it move the needle? I don't know what to do with the 78% of people used to buy their books on Amazon. Do I believe that? I'm not sure what else to do.
And like they don't buy them anywhere else anymore. Like that's.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's hard to know. I think the thing I will say is that bookshop.org has been good for bookshop.org, and there's at least a few bookstores I'm willing to believe that have benefited from it greatly. Has it been sort of egalitarianly across the board a win for everyone participating? I don't think that's probably all that interesting.
I'd be interested in hearing more about the affiliate structure, like 51,000 and change affiliates is interesting. Who are the biggest ones? How many books do they sell from the most? Like that, I think, has more potential to change the landscape of books and reading is people deciding to link their book links to something other than Amazon. And 51,000 affiliates is a small drop in the bucket in the pool of everyone on the internet who links to books to sell them. But it's not nothing. And if some of those sources are big, maybe it's a Substack with a million subscribers. And some of those people are buying their books through the Bookshop links instead of Amazon, which is a thing that I've seen. I'd be really interested in that. Like, that's a bigger shift for the whole marketplace if you can shift people's online shopping habits in general rather than focusing on shifting purchasing into independent bookstores.
The number we don't get, so there's 51,000 affiliates. How much money has been paid out to them? I don't think I have that number. Yeah, I don't see it. Sometimes what they don't put in these puff pieces is interesting. That's one that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do another sponsor break and take a quick tour of Bandland and try not to visit very long. We're not going to stay overnight, but we're going to drive through real quick.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia Senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode.
All right, Rebecca, you're in charge of this quick road trip tour of like the volcanic caldera, to use Yellowstone terminology, of the this week in book banning. Where do you want, where does your interest fall?
Yeah, you know, this week's highlights that I have decided to talk about are not as bad as some of the things we've seen. And the first one is a case where I think it's the first case that I've seen where the students sued the school district. Honestly, we talk about so many of these that might not be the first one. It's the first one that I remember. But in Wentzville, which is outside St. Louis, the school board voted earlier this week 7-0 to keep challenged books in the school libraries. This was just hours after students filed a lawsuit against the district for removing other books. Two students sued the school district for violating their civil rights by banning books, including The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. Lawyers for the ACLU of Missouri were representing the two students who were identified only by their initials, and they were discussing that removing the books threatens the students' abilities to learn and engage with a diversity of ideas and information, including seeing their own experiences reflected in the books and developing greater understanding of the experiences of others. On that same Tuesday, the board unanimously approved the recommendation of the district's book challenge committee to keep Gabby, A Girl in Pieces by Isabel Quintero. It's a coming-of-age story about a Mexican-American teenager. It had been challenged by one parent for foul language and a depiction of rape. So that's the information that we have about this. We're seeing these kinds of things all over the place, like really, really all over the place. And if you're following book banning news, Kelly Jensen at Book Riot is covering a lot of censorship stuff on our site, so you can keep track of the news tab over there if this is something that you really want to keep an eye on. But I thought this was notable in that, you know, there had been the challenge against Gabby, A Girl in Pieces. These students filed a suit over the ban that included, or the challenge that included, The Bluest Eye and some others, and then the school board decided to keep them on. We don't have a lot of like record of that conversation in the school board meeting. The reasoning for it sounds like the complaint for the first title at least was just presented by one parent, but I was heartened to see students leading this charge. That feels to me a little bit like the kids are going to be all right. And I think it's a really interesting approach for the ACLU to tackle this as a violation of students' civil liberties. If a case like this makes its way to court, because a school board doesn't do what the Wentzville school board has done here and just keep books on the shelves, I'll be really interested to see that. I think it's the first time that I've seen that argument. So I would love to, if there are, you know, some legal beagles among our listeners, I'd love to hear any insights about this or precedent for it, why it might be more successful than other approaches that folks have taken to responding to attempts to challenge and ban books. But I was really heartened by that. And if you want to be a little birdie, you can email us at podcast@bookriot.com.
That's a great point, Rebecca. I hadn't thought about the supra ramifications of legal challenges on behalf of the students. I really like the idea. I wish they didn't have to do it, I should say. Students having to stick up for these books and the stories that speak to them, or the stories they want to hear, or just their ability to access these stories. I think it does change the equation for people trying to ban stuff or get taken off a list or whatever else it might be, because to this point, it's largely these books are these sort of non-human, just object things, and the authors behind them usually don't live around there. They're kind of absent people, and so book banning on in one sense can seem like a victimless crime, because it feels like you're doing disservice to these books or authors that have books everywhere and they don't live in the locality. And this really suggests and puts, you know, physical manifestation to, no, the people that are the victims here, or the anti-beneficiaries, to use a more neutral or maybe spin term, are the students in there, right? Because if books matter, then having or not having access to those books matters to the people accessing them. In this case, these are students, right? These are the people that are having their experience formed, curtailed outside of the pall of what they might want, or what their teachers, who are directly responsible for their curriculum, or libraries responsible for development collection, everything else, want. This is the student saying, "No, wait a minute. We have a voice in this. We are the ones that are the consumers of these services, these goods and services, these books and teaching and librarian and access. No one's really thinking about us from what we might actually want out of, oh no, they might read something that turns them gay, I guess, or something like, yeah, like that's what the thing that's said in a lot of these situations.
Yeah. One of the things that Kelly has been hammering home in her coverage of censorship for Book Riot is that it's not actually about the books. It's about attempts to gain power and control over the education system, and to like pull power out of the system and give it back, or put it into, not even give it back, put it into the hands of individual parents who represent typically a pretty far right, pretty conservative approach to things. This is not actually about a particular title or about let's protect the children, but seeing the children speak back to that argument is really powerful. And I think at least shines a light onto the rupture in that argument that these far right folks tend to make of like, think of the children, protect the children. And when the kids are saying, no, we want access to these books, like you're going to have to fight that battle of gaining control in the school system some other way, because we're going to stand here and tell you that this is not about protecting us. You're harming us. Yeah. I think that's really powerful, and I'd love to see it gain some steam.
Yeah, me too. Good job, Heroes of the Week, the students, getting their hands dirty there. Let's end with a little Front List Corner, where we're gonna have one title this week. We can do more as we're figuring out the ways to do this. We need an entry for this. So I've used the phrase before for me, that there's books are either special books or they aren't. There can be great books that I really like that are not special books, and this is a very idiosyncratic way of thinking about it. I need a new term here. Because if I'd done this in print, I'm not sure I would call this a special book, but I did not. I did it in audio, which I think makes it rise to be a special audio book. It's Heartbreak by Florence Williams. And it's special because we haven't heard that many of these, where it's a audio book that's produced kind of like a long form NPR kind of podcast, where you've got audio throughout. You've got original audio from participants in striking ways here we can talk about in a minute. But I'm putting this is a special book double hash mark asterisk next to Florence Williams's heartbreak for the experience alone, but it goes with the content as well. Rebecca, do you want to take a moment to tell the people what the content here is?
Yes, I just want to first second that emotion. I've read Florence Williams' other books. She had a great book about breasts that was called Breasts several years ago, and The Nature Fix, which is about the science of why going outside is good for us, which I obviously loved. So I was going to read Heartbreak anyway. I think I would have enjoyed it. But you're right that the audio is a really, really special experience. And I would love to talk to her about it, because I wonder if this started as an audio project and somehow got morphed into an audio project that they could make a print version of. It kind of feels like it
There's a reason why it feels that.
So the setup is that she was going through a divorce, the end of a 30-year marriage, and wanted to learn like basically how to cope with it, but through the scientific lens of what happens in our bodies, what's happening in our brains and our nervous systems when we go through heartbreak. And there's not a whole lot of research about that, but she finds people whose work is adjacent to it, and people who talk about trauma, and people who studied love, but who now study the end of relationships and all kinds of things. And so the content is really interesting. But what makes this so special is that, like, you get audio recordings that she made on her phone from, like, sitting on the bank of a river that she was kayaking by herself as one of the ways that she was trying to move through the pain of this heartbreak. So, like, live in the moment stuff. There's lunches that she had with her girlfriends where she puts her recorder on the table and you just hear them real talk her about, like, why she let this guy that she was dating treat her in a particular way. And probably the thing that put us most over the edge was the first man that she has a romantic relationship with after the divorce agrees to be in the book, like, his voice. They have conversations on the audiobook, and, like, what happens on those dates is not particularly flattering for him. And we had a whole, like, we had a whole text exchange about how we couldn't have a text exchange talking about that whole segment, because
what we talk about when we talk about her relationship with Ennis is kind of the meta discourse. Yeah.
It was like just that little see no evil emoji, the monkey with its hands over its eyes. Like,
I know that you know that I know what we're talking about, but we're not going to talk about it.
Can you believe that she was, like, bold enough to put it in there, and that that guy signed a release to have his voice in there? And, you know, also live interviews with the researchers that she goes and speaks to. So it's not just, like, pull quotes in a book, but real conversations in real time that she was having. And, I mean, it feels like each chapter is a podcast episode. Yes. And I would listen to one of these a couple times a week for the rest of my life.
Listen, we've done a lot of Pushkin talk recently. I don't know if we said this, or this is a Pushkin audiobook production. Right, right. I think the print book is distributed by Norton. I don't know what the chicken and the egg situation here is. But I think I said to you that I now will give I'll give Pushkin the benefit of the doubt if they have an audiobook coming out, because it's just a different kind of experience. Their taste is really good, but the production quality is fascinating. And there's just something different about having the actual tape. Yeah, that's how I'm dating myself. The actual recording of these things. Now, Florence, she doesn't start recording from, like, the big bang of the divorce. I think the first recording is 6 months later, which I think is humane for her and for us, and maybe didn't have the ideal till later. I think it's very delicate about her family, especially, and her husband, and it's really about her and her dealing with it and all the things that's been out about it. But in terms of an audio production, this is like the X-Men. This is Homo Superior of audio production here. This is the next, like, thing to go, and it's very expensive to do. It's much more time consuming. But I now find myself in listening to nonfiction. I have to tell you, I'm listening to something I like a lot more, or I like very well, that I find myself saying, boy, I wish that section that was could have been interview tape actually in the thing. I wish this thing that they're describing, you could have had a sound cue for it. And again, not everyone's going to do it, because audiobooks are, you know, you have to put it into the P&L of making the audiobook for sure. But if you can't, this is a situation, I was thinking about this too. This is a space where most people don't care about imprints. This is one, if they did this well consistently, they did four titles a year only that were this high quality, I would say, what's the new Pushkin book? And people will know what I'm talking about. Like, there's an opportunity to really own this space.
I think that's so, right.
Anyway, yeah. There we go.
It has bled into my listening of other things as well. Or I'm reading in nonfiction. I'm not done with it yet, so I won't fully talk about it. In the Shadow of the Mountains by Sylvia Vasquez Lovato.
Great example.
Yeah, which is, it's wonderful. And she's hiking in the Himalayas. She's trying to hike Everest with a group of women who are victims of sex trafficking.
Yes.
And she's leading them. She was the victim of childhood sexual abuse. And they have these, she describes these big conversations about their experience, about what's happening to them while they're out in nature having this experience with their bodies and how it's healing and challenging. And, you know, for obvious reasons, she might not have wanted to plop a tape recorder on the table in those moments, but it would be powerful to hear them on audio. And I think, like, now that I know this can be done because I've heard Florence Williams do it, I can't unknow that. And it's going to make me want it from a whole bunch of other things.
And frankly, it helps me with a price premium for an audiobook, right? Because I know that that takes more. Like, it's not just, and I was just doing Power of Regret by Daniel Pink. I'm not sure if I talked about it last week or not, but I did that. That's Daniel Pink reading the text that shows up the same. Why am I paying $19 for that? Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to the audio, the ebook or something else. It's funny you would mention that sequence, because in Heartbreak, there is a scene where Florence Williams goes on a hiking trip with people who are recovering from sex trafficking.
Well, it goes both ways, because in The Shadow of the Mountains, there's a moment where she quotes Florence Williams' The Nature Fix.
That's unbelievable.
So I just
stuff.
Need to figure out if they... Yeah, I'm having like a weird reading synchronicity moment. They probably know of each other.
No, but I'm just saying, like, you hear what the version would be like, because it's in Heartbreak of her recording and she gets permission and everything else. So it was one of those, I haven't had an experience like this before. And I know Gladwell's Talking to Strangers and Bomber Mafia were similar to this. I did not do them that way. I read Bomber Mafia in ebook, and then I didn't get to Talking to Strangers because I didn't want to do it. But it's a good enough experience now that I'm like, that's a differentiation that if they could make it clear, if they could be the Pixar of audiobooks like this, where it's just qualitatively better, that is super interesting to see. I don't know if they, again, the problem you have, as you said, is you have to record in the moments, and you may not know you have a book deal till later. Like, you may not know, like, there's going to have to be a little hand in gloveness going on with it, but such is life. But I'm going to be looking out, and it's good. The burden
really
of proof is going to be on me not to listen to future Pushkin joints. It is.
Yeah.
Okay. That's got to be our show for today. Podcast at bookriot.com. If you have Patreon subscription ideas, they're going to be linked in the show notes, as we said, to a survey, also at bookriot.com/listen. The last for now Adaptation Nation is available. Sharif and I did a episode on The Color Purple on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of The Color Purple. Let me just say, what a wild time the early 80s were for this kind of product to be made. I told Rebecca this. I don't think it made it into the show, so it's a little bonus here, that my favorite factoid that came out of mine and Sharif's research was that Whoopi Goldberg, who got the part of Celie, Spielberg, who directed the movie, got turned around on her, seeing her perform a imitation of E.T., but E.T. high, while getting pulled over for a drug bust in Oakland. That's how she got the job. I'll leave you with that, Rebecca. I left you with that the other day. I will leave it again now. Thank you all so much for listening.
Okay, y'all have a good one.
All right.